the unconstrained optimization. You have to do unconstrained optimization in this case.
And
No, you're not on the constraint all the time. If it's important for you to stay on the constraint, you really want to do unconstrained optimization. I'm actually going to talk about this right now for a few examples, so it will be maybe a bit clearer. That's of course the million dollar question. Do you want to solve a nonlinear system of equations every time, or you want to? I'll talk about this right now, so it will be okay. Let me start the third and last part of this thing, which is really what we're doing here. Correct? PDE is an optimization. So apparently now we arrive to PDE is an optimization finally, and so we've done PDEs, we've done optimization. The question is, why are we actually giving it some thought? I mean, why not? What's so special about this thing? Why we just don't use optimization for PDE problems and that's it? I mean, there's nothing to think about. So, I mean, there are people that are doing that, by the way. There are a lot of people that are solving PDE optimization problem by simply using their best optimization routine, whatever it is. However, I believe that you should think about it in a bit different way, because there is, as you're going to see in a second, for PDE optimization problems, two sides. There is a PDE side, and there is an optimization side. And then there is a combined view. And what you want to try to do, and this is what I personally believe in. It's not, some people don't believe, I mean, many people do not believe in that. So I'm going to tell you what I believe in. And again, I may be thinking, which is in a way, which is not with what other people are, but so you can take my view or not take it. But I personally think that you should combine the views, and you should try to take the best from both worlds. So looking, I think, at the whole problem just as a PDE, which you can, as I'm going to show you, is a possibility. Some people do that. They solve the whole thing as a PDE system, and that's it. Another option is to solve the whole thing as an optimization problem, forgetting the problem that there is a PDE here. Completely doable. I think that if you do these two, you're actually losing something that you can gain if you combine the view and understand what the relationship is. Okay. So what is the difference again is that the first thing is the constraints. Remember that we have these constraints. The constraints are the PDEs, so it's a huge number of constraints. If you think again, think about the simple three-dimensional, two-dimensional even discretization of the heat equation. If I'm using 64 times to discretize my PDE on 64 times, and it's on a grid of 64 by 64, then the number of constraints I have for this kind of problem is 64 cube. And that's a huge number of constraints if you look at optimization papers. Usually they solve problems with 1,000 constraints, 2,000 constraints. You can get to millions of constraints with no problem with these kind of issues. I mean, trivial problems lead to millions of constraints. Okay. Conditioning, again, can be bad. And again, the meat of the problem is usually on the PDE side. Okay. I'm going to do a model problem over here. So I'm going to kind of concentrate on the model problem rather than trying to give you the theory or whatever they read for everything. I'm just going to try to look at one problem and then try to deduce something out from this problem which is more general. So remember this hydrology problem? Actually, there is another typo here. This Q should be basically identity, so it will be U minus B. Okay, so this I'm trying to minimize the difference between U minus B. B is some observed field. And there is going to be a term here which we call regularization, which I'm not going to get into why and what's the reason we put it in, subject to this PDE, okay, with some boundary conditions. Okay, so here we have U and M. Okay, this is a nonlinear connection between U and M, because although it's a linear PDE for U, when you don't know U and you don't know M, they multiply each other some here. They have the e to the m multiply the grad of U, so it's a nonlinear connection. So it's a nonlinear connection between U and M, and then you have to minimize something here. Okay. Now, these are very, very popular choices for that thing. One of them is just taking the inner product here. One is just taking what we call total variation norm. Again, this is just, you'll see it in the literature. For this problem, again, I'm going to assume that I'm discretizing the problem first and then optimizing. Now, here is the first, this is the first place that you can argue, since some people actually do. Now, the reason I like to discretize this problem first and then optimize, and this is actually an important point, is that I just described to you a bunch of techniques to do optimization. Well, all these techniques are relating to the fact that I can do optimization on a discrete problem. For example, when I'm doing a line search, I want my function to be smaller than, my next function is going to be smaller than the previous one. So, in some way, if my problem is discrete, it's very clear to me. If the problem is continuous, this is not so clear because there is a discretization error, which is non-trivial. It's an h squared but times some constant, which you don't really know. So now, smaller is not enough. There has to be smaller, but you have to consider the h squared there in somewhere. So simple algorithms like a line search, trust regions, can become much more involved when you're doing the problem optimizing than discretizing. On the other hand, if you discretize and optimize, all the machinery, for example, of line search and trust regions and all the rest of the merit functions is there to work with. I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to start thinking how it interchanges with the discretization. I have to worry about other things, as I'm going to talk about later on, but I can solve a discrete optimization problem. Okay? One of the things that I do have to worry, I'll say it now, but you'll see it later, I'll have to worry about the fact that the solution to the discrete problem has some connection to the solution of the continuous problem. And this, although looks kind of clear maybe now, it may not be at all. So you may be solving a discrete problem, and at the end you look at the solution, and it has no connection whatsoever to do with the continuous problem. I'll show you an example. Okay. So here's my discretization. Well, we know how to do the gradient. We just did it the first part. So here's the gradient that we did before. Okay. And there is an h to d because there was an integral here, so it's replaced by h to d. This is just becomes a 2-norm in this case. And here we have our matrix, which is discretized, and A depends now on M. Okay, so here it is, the discrete problem. So again, just to remind you, for this specific problem, on a grid which is three-dimensional, this easily a million variables, so you have a million constraints. The objective here is actually very simple. It's just a quadratic constraint here, quadratic objective. Okay, so what did we say the methods that you can use? Well, we said when we went before, we said that the first method is elimination, correct? The first thing is constraint elimination. So here it is, constraint elimination. Write U is equal A inverse Q. Done, no constraint. Plug it in, it's in here. And we have an unconstrained optimization problem. Okay, that looks simple enough, so why don't we do that? If you want to think about it, there is an A inverse here. So now evaluating this function over here involved with solving a large, sparse but large, linear system of equations. So just evaluating the function is expensive. So this is obviously a complication. If you're going to need to evaluate your function a few times just to, of course, see that you're getting to some minimum, then, that's not going to be an easy thing to do. So the gradient, actually, you can show that it involves another solution of another PDE that's also something which is going to be hard to do. So all these kind of things are hard to do. Nevertheless, if you look at these kind of problems, the method that is used by most people in the world is this. Okay? People actually do constraint elimination. And the reason is that doing unconstrained optimization is a very easy thing in a sense from the optimization perspective. Not necessarily from the PDE perspective, but from the optimization perspective. Everybody understands how to generate sequence of points to do these kind of things. There is this machinery. It's not necessarily the best computationally, as we're going to discuss, but it is definitely an easy way out if you have a black box solver for this type. Okay. Okay, but since we're trying to do something interesting and also computationally more efficient, we don't want to invert this matrix every time, and what we may want to do is to use the machinery we just talked about. So here is the same objective function that we have before, and here is the other term for the Lagrangian. This is basically the PDE. So we added lambda transpose, which is the Lagrange multipliers, times the discrete PDE to the whole thing. Okay. Now, the necessary conditions that we talked just before said that we have to differentiate it with respect to U, to M, and to lambda, and to make it zero, and look at it. See what we get out of this. So differentiate with respect to lambda, that's always the easiest thing to do. That's why I always do it first. And you just get the PDE back. Okay, that's the constraint. Now, if you differentiate with respect to u, well, you get something interesting here. So this is u minus b, comes from the first step, easy. From the last one, you get a transpose lambda. Now, if the system is symmetric, like in our case, you don't need the transpose, but I'm going to leave it just for sake of completion. The problem doesn't have to be symmetric. Even with boundary conditions can change things. So this system, if you now think about the system in a bit different way, take u and b and put it in the other side. Now you're left with A transpose lambda is equal to something, correct? You can think about it as a problem with a transpose. So it's like the adjoint problem. This is called the adjoint problem in many cases. So you have a Lagrange multiplier, which is the adjoint variable, and you have an adjoint problem for the adjoint variable. the adjoint problem in this case turned to be a PDE by itself, the adjoint PDE. Okay, so obviously, if this was not a piece of cake, also this may not be a piece of cake. But it's a similar structure, a similar type of problem. Differentiating with respect to M actually is not much more complicated in practice, but usually from a coding point of view require more work, because this is something that we usually don't have for the sim. So this is one point, again, to think when you're writing your simulator to do whatever simulation you want, you usually know how to get this matrix, this A. Even if the problem is nonlinear, this will be usually your Jacobian. To get this matrix, usually your simulator doesn't really know how to do. And this is why people talk about automatic differentiation and other things that I did not discuss that can get this thing automatically. Although there are methods to get this thing automatically, this is not so simple. And in some cases, actually, you can show that if you just get it naively automatically, this will be so complicated, although it's not. It can be a very simple matrix. Most of the time, it's actually a very sparse matrix. Now, it comes from the differentiation of A of M, the matrix, times U with respect to M. Okay? It's going to be a sparse matrix. It's going to have a certain structure. And it's problem dependent. Okay? What is the structure of this thing have? Now, I'm going to call this matrix G from now on. And you'll see this in the next slide. Just remember, it's a sparse matrix, and it's important to remember. And it's actually easy to compute when you do it yourself, at least. So here is one first observation. We talked about the unconstrained approach when you eliminate your constraint. And just remember that evaluating the function was complicated, and also evaluating the gradient was complicated. Evaluating the function here involves only sparse matrices, or the Lagrangian involve only sparse matrices. Evaluating the gradient involves only sparse matrices, obviously no problem. I can evaluate this kind of stuff easily. That's the point to remember.
Wouldn't you say that maybe a Tikhonov approach would be like a third way or something in the middle?
When you mean Tikhonov, you mean?
Like you just add that constraint, mm-hmm. but you do it in a parameter-dependent.
A penalty approach. Yeah. But the penalty approach, again, has the problem that you have to derive the parameter to zero, and then you get your condition here. So here's an interesting view. Now this is the interesting point when you have to look at the stuff. Okay, so here's the system that we saw before. Okay, this is the system. This was the adjoint problem. That's the forward problem. And this is the problem in the middle with this matrix here. Now, the interesting point when you're looking at the PDE world is that you can interpret this thing back and forth as a PDE. Okay, so here's the interesting point. The adjoint problem is actually, you can interpret it as this PDE. Okay, so you have div e to the m grad lambda is equal to this. Because this is A, remember? The forward problem is this, and this problem here, well, grad H transpose grad H, that's Laplacian, because correct, that's div grad minus Laplacian. So here is minus Laplacian, okay? And if you carefully look at this thing, and this is where you actually have to carefully look, and this is, again, the difference between just optimizing and optimizing with PDEs, because if you just optimize, just get something, but you're not really clear what you got out. If you actually look at what this thing, what does this thing correspond to, what kind of differential operator this corresponds to, it corresponds to this kind of operator. Okay, so you can actually look at this problem as two things. Either it's a nonlinear system of equations that comes from the optimization problem, or it's a coupled system of PDEs. Here it is, a coupled system of nonlinear PDEs. It's nonlinear because there are these terms over here, all these terms that multiply each other, and they're coupled. So these are two ways to see these things. And now every algorithm I have, I can interpret it either as solving the discrete system, but you can also think about the underlying PDE. And I think it's very useful to think about the underlying PDE while you're doing a certain algorithm. Okay, so let's talk about the famous KKT system that we're talking about all the time. So here's the system here. Here's the system of nonlinear equations. Well, the KKT system can be viewed as a simple Newton solution for this kind of problem, right? If I just try to do a Newton's method on this problem, this is what I get. So, by the way, it's easy to think if you do a Newton's method, differentiate with respect to U, this one you get identity, here you get differentiate with respect to lambda, you get A, with respect to M, you get something, but you may not want to do this. So, I mean, you can get stuff here. It's easy to see how you get this KKT matrix. And here is the KKT matrix. There are two things I dropped here. So there is these entries. Actually, why am I fighting so hard this? There are two entries here. Oops. The other way. I guess you have to be coordinated with this. The other way. Okay, so it's exactly where it stands a second ago, which is here. I dropped a term. And the reason I dropped the term is not related to this lecture specifically, but you can actually show, it's easy to show, that in this case, the matrix is actually, the reduced gradient we showed yesterday was symmetric positive definite. And you can see that because the diagonal part, the A, the first 2x2 block, is going to be basically positive definite here, right? So the reduced gradient is also going to be positive definite. No negative eigenvalues. That's going to generate some good properties in this case. Okay. But this is the KKT system. So it's our bad KKT system that can have many, many problems. Now, if you just look at it as a KKT and you forget where it's coming from, you immediately think this is a bad KKT, hard to deal with. Okay. Now, let's go and see what does this corresponds to in terms of differential operators. Well, here is this identity, here is thus our forward problem, and here is our, well, the adjunct of the forward problem is exactly the same. And this is this operator that this matrix G corresponds to, and this is its adjoint, actually. I think I maybe missed a minus sign over here. But this is up to a minus sign, this is what you have here. So for an operator point of view, let's think about it for a second. What do we have here? Okay, this is an identity. This is a second order. So this is like 1 over h squared. This is beta times 1 over h squared. This is, on the other hand, a first order operator because this is grad u. U is known, correct? There's only the gradient here, which is the unknown. So there is 1 over h from here, second order operator, and first order operator again. So if you think about this, second order, second order, second order, all the rest are either first or zero order. So that implies that maybe looking at it as a KKT system, if this beta is, let's say, order 1, is maybe not the right way to do it. Because if beta is order 1, why should I worry about KKT and stuff like that when I can just simply do a very simple change, which is this, which is a non-symmetric change. So now I have AA and this part over here, which again corresponds to this second order differential operator, second order and second order. This is only first order identity. So the meat of this stuff is on the diagonal. If the meat is on the diagonal, that may be easier to solve. And actually, numerically, you can actually try this yourself, as they say, and find out yourself that if beta is large, it's order 1, it's extremely easy to solve this non-symmetric matrix with almost any method that you want with a relatively simple preconditioner. Okay, you don't have to be very sophisticated in terms of preconditioning to actually do this kind of thing. Versus the KKT system that we've seen before that was complicated to solve. So again, this is where the optimization and the PDE kind of interacts. If you are aware of what your stuff in the matrix is, you can use it in order to generate better solver for the optimization, rather than just trying to do a straightforward KKT type technique. Okay?
It does force you to solve it all at once. You can't take advantage of the parts there, or eliminate.
You can do it still. Yeah, but you can still do it over here. For example, you can eliminate, this part and this part and this part. And then some people even wrote paper about this. So papers about it. So it's a question of what you want to eliminate. Also allows you, if you do it in this view, it's just maybe different parts of what you want to eliminate. But I mean, the important point is that you can view things either or and change the problem. Now, this, of course, all what I said right now is completely not correct if beta is very small. So if beta is very small, if beta was 1, then, again, there is almost no coupling. It's actually it's a diagonally dominant system of PDEs, and there's no coupling, it's easy to solve. If now beta is very small, well, the fact that this is so very small, I'm thinking about order h and lower. So again, if this is h squared, but you multiply by h, then this is basically becoming order 1 over h, but this is here, it's a gradient operator times something. So this is also 1 over h, so that's it. It's not anymore diagonally dominant. I'm stuck. So this kind of approach is not going to help me. Okay, so I need now to do something else. And then it's useful to look at it again as a KKT system. So then this view is actually helpful, looking at it in this KKT kind of form, because then I can use maybe other techniques, other KKT techniques, like the techniques I was talking about yesterday, to solve it when the problem is very coupled. So which way to look at it is useful because the solver for this kind of problem will depend on beta, but it also depends on our interpretation and our understanding of what the problem is and where it's coming from. Or in some way, I always like to say this to him because we always like to argue. He's he's the linear algebra guy. I always tell him, a matrix is not just a matrix. It has a history. It's like you have to know it. It's like a person. You can't just treat it as a matrix. So in some way, this is you know, this matrix have a history. It comes from a PDE. It has some stuff in it. You can't just treat it like a matrix, a KKT matrix in a sense. So, again, if beta is small, you have to do something about it. And you can do many things about the whole thing if beta is small. So one thing is you can do, and you know, people here, Scott is going to talk about multigrid methods. For example, even if beta is very small, you can still do multigrid for the whole system and treat it as a PDE. It's more complicated, it's more involved, but you can still do these things. And then there are preconditioners based on elimination. And again, they're based on the fact that I know what the PDEs are. But it's an important essence. There are many, many methods. I'm not going to try to talk about all of them, but this was just a demonstration that you can look at things in dual way. One of the preconditioners that few people actually did at the same time, so Omar Gattas and George B. Ross have done this in Courant, and actually in Carnegie Mellon, and we have done this over here. And luckily enough, we're in completely remote fields, so we can still stay friends after we've done this. And we actually took this matrix in this non-symmetric form, and we decomposed it, and then we just look at this and say, oh, you see there is this A inverse, so we just now, A inverse, well, it's an inverse of a PDE. So what do? We approximate it by somehow. So we have techniques. We listened to Ellison yesterday. We have techniques to do this. So you can come up with these kind of approximations if you know what to do with this. So again, I'm trying to kind of try to tell you that you can combine these two approaches, the continuous approach of looking at it as a PDE and the algebraic approach, through complement, elimination, whatever it is, when you need it. It's just important to know which piece comes from where. Okay. So, again, solving KKT systems, and this is my view on things, may not be the view of many other people, is not necessarily hard. Some KKT systems are extremely easy to solve, and that depends if you can make them diagonally dominant or not. If it's easy to make them diagonally dominant, it's not hard. The fact that they're KKT is a completely redundant part. The fact you can present them as a hard problem is not necessarily mean that they're hard. If, on the other hand, there is a strong coupling, you can't get rid of their KKT nature. That makes it very hard. And it's important to remember this dual view because that allows you to switch back and forth between, you know, is it really a hard problem? Is it not? What can I do in order to make it easier? Okay, so this is the general guideline, and it's going to be different for different problems. So a few words about globalization. And now, I didn't say this before, and it hit me back in this break, that I just talk about global versus local methods, and global methods of looking for the global minimum. But I'm just talking about globalization of trying to find the local minima when you start very, very far away. You're still going to converge to the local minima, not trying to find the global minimum in a sense. So here is the update. So we solved the KKT system somehow, okay, one of these techniques we just talked about. And you just go and you update here, and alpha is going to be a line search. And the line search is such that you're going to decrease this merit function. So again, you have this the objective function here, and the constraints over here with a 1 norm, and there is a 1 over mu. Now, choosing this mu may not be trivial. It actually, in this case, it relates to the Lagrange multiplier, but if you solve it inaccurately, it can be hard. Also, there are some effects that can come. So some things can happen if you just use this objective function naively and you don't do anything to compensate for these kind of things. It's actually a complicated topic by itself. It's called the Maratos effect, for those of you who are interested. And there are a few papers about this thing. But it's not so straightforward, for example, to actually update and to choose again what is the next good iterate. It's something that is a non-trivial. And I think all these constrained optimization problems, it's a very non-trivial part of the whole thing. So we just say, oh yeah, we solved that KKT system, now we update. But it's not so trivial to decide how you update your problem. Okay, so let's look at an example for this hydrology problem that I just presented to you. And I'm just going I'm going to solve this thing now in the approach that is just presented to you. So I'm going to generate the KKT system every time. And after I'm generating the KKT system, I'm going to solve it, okay, inexactly actually. And then I'm going to look at two things. I'm going to look at the constraint, okay, so how far am I from the constraint? And the second thing is, how far am I from what's the gradient, or the gradient of the Lagrangian? Okay. And I'm doing it for a certain beta here. So let me kind of trace back, maybe all the way back to where we started, kind of. So this was the problem, okay, here, maybe one even more. So here, so we want to, oops, no, even here. Even here. So we want to minimize this thing, okay? So this is the constraint, and what I'm interested to know is how much am I violating the constraint? How far am I from actually solving that PD every time I'm doing the optimization? And the second thing, I want to know what the gradient of the Lagrangian is. Okay, so these are the two things I'm going to follow through this process. And then fixing beta to be something. So here's nonlinear iterations. I need to do four linear iterations. I have a preconditioner here, which I just discussed kind of vaguely, very vaguely. Which again, it requires another completely big talk. And you can see that with this preconditioner, it's very, actually, I need very, very few iterations for the KKT matrix to be solved. And then when I'm looking at the constraints, so look at what happened here. This is actually an interesting thing. I'm starting with a large constraint, and I'm slowly decreasing the constraint until it's 10 to the minus 7. So actually, maybe talk about the gradient here, which is also reducing. And this is where I call it acceptable, and I quit. Now, what is so interesting about this kind of approach? If you think about the elimination of constraints, you'll find out that every time you eliminate the constraints, you're actually doing a very expensive thing. Here, we're slowly approaching the constraints. So we're not really solving the PDE on the first. So you have a parameter, M, a parameter that you want to work with. And now you're not solving the PDE fully for this parameter. But as we said, this was something that I said before about a guideline for general algorithm type things that you want to do. You don't want to solve the wrong problem very accurately. So you have the wrong model anyway. You're going to switch it in a second. So why solve the PDE accurately for that one? It's something that principally you don't want to do. And this is what happens here naturally, because the first iteration, you're just solving the PDE to 10 to the minus 3. And then you're increasingly solving the PDE until you get to 10 to the minus 7, or 10 to the minus 6, more or less. But this is as you are tightening your bounds. This is what you want to see from an algorithm, in a sense. You don't want to solve problems that are no use for you to a very high accuracy. Then you can change the beta, because obviously you don't know necessarily what the beta is going to be, and you can do the same thing. And you can see kind of even from here that as beta decreases, the problem becomes more coupled. It takes more iterations to solve. But the same overall idea is that I am, well, now I started very close, I'm actually tightening my tolerance slowly. Okay, that's an important thing. Okay, so this is, by the way, the pictures that you can always present. So this is the true hydraulic conductivity that you have, and this is the recovered one. Not that it's very important, but for purpose of the application, it is. Okay, the second problem I want to talk about is actually a problem that is interesting in the sense that it has an interesting pitfall. So there is something that can be very, very wrong, and you can do something very, very bad if you just, you know, I was just advocating all the time that you should discretize and optimize. But this is where you have to be careful that you can do this, but you can run into difficulties, and you can do something which is not very smart if you don't think about what you're doing. Okay. So here's the same problem. Okay, I want to minimize some observation, U minus B, the same gradient, okay, but now I just changed the PDE. What's the big deal? Just change the PDE. It's not really a big deal, correct? So here's the PDE. Okay, MUXX minus UTT is a wave equation. Okay, one-dimensional wave equation with some initial conditions. Okay, so overall, it's a very similar structure. Implies that I should use the same method. So all I need to do is I need to discretize this PDE somehow. And then if I discretize this PDE, well, we have all this machinery with all this KKT stuff that I just talked about. We can just use it, right? That's what I just said before. So let's discretize it. And in this case, it's a wave equation. So standard discretization will be a leapfrog method. So okay, let's use leapfrog. What is going to be leapfrog? Well, you discretize this. This is coming from the second derivative operator. And this is un plus 1 minus 2 un. Okay, minus 1 is basically the second derivative, and the delta t square is kind of lumped into here. Okay. Now, you can immediately see that if you take the un plus 1 to this side, you basically have a method that solves for un plus 1 with almost zero work. Basically, you just have to multiply this matrix times this. No matrix solver, no nothing like that. But you have to remember that there is a stability condition. The stability condition says that m inverse delta t has to be smaller than delta x. Now, this is I'm going to kind of stop over here for a second and explain something about it. So the CFL condition everybody knows about, it's not a big deal, okay, great. But now you have to remember, what are we doing when we're doing optimization? We're trying to find M, correct? This is what we're going to try to find. We don't know what M is. This is the unknown of our problem. So how do we know what our CFL condition is? Well, we don't. We maybe have an upper bound if we know what the upper bound of M, but if we don't know even what the upper bound is, or the lower bound, we don't even know what the CFL condition is. So we're in trouble in some way. We don't know how to keep our stuff stable. So because we're naive right now, what we do is we basically take a delta t and a delta x in some way, and we just pick it up. Because we say it's a discretization, we just discretize it on any kind of way we want. And we assume that m is going to be something. So we say m 0.1 looks fine. Okay, let's pick delta t, let's pick delta x. It's going to be fine. If I pick delta m to be 0.1, that's going to be, m is going to be 0.1. Everything is stable. I can solve the PDE, no problem. Okay, so we do that. So now before we go to all the machinery, I have to try to present, so this is a recursive equation for a delta, for u. I need to present it as a big matrix so I can use the same machinery I had before. And this is what I'm going to do. So if you think about, again, this kind of, so u0, u1 are basically u at different times. So u0 for the zeroth time, u1 for the first time, and so on. This is what this matrix, this is what the whole thing looks like. Again, it's a lower trigonal system. And it basically tells you that you can calculate the nth value by knowing what's the previous ones before. And again, you don't need to invert any matrix, just multiplying a matrix will do for you. So this is the matrix. Okay, so to solve it, it's just a simple forward substitution or backward substitution. Okay. So we now have a matrix. Okay, so it's the same problem. So this was, so actually I noted as A here. Okay, so we have A of M times U is equal Q. Okay, A of M, U is equal Q. Before it was div sigma grad, now it's something else. So what? What's the big deal? The same mechanism we have before. Plug it in, go. Okay? Just we have an algorithm already, so we can use it. So we're going to try to use the same optimization routine. So here is a numerical example. So I'm using delta x is 1.56 to the minus 2, delta t 3.12, and my initial m inverse is 0.2, so I'm starting with a constant. And there is no problem with a CFL condition. I can go ahead and solve this. This is unconditional. It's stable for this problem. I can just go ahead and solve. That's what I do. So I plug it all into the optimization package and try to solve it. Okay. So here's what I get. Okay. This is the true thing. It's like a sine wave, lifted sine wave. Okay. So here's the true thing. Here is what I get for the m. So I get basically nothing. And I can't get something which is reasonable. And as I try to reduce my regularization parameter, things do not behave better. Okay, I just can't get anything to work. And in principle, I have all this data. I mean, you saw that before for the elliptic problem, I could get something which was maybe not exact, but reasonable. This is supposed to be even a better problem. It's a wave equation. It's supposed to localize things. How come I cannot get anything reasonable out of this thing? I mean, how come this really breaks completely? So this is exactly where, again, the PDEs and optimization interact with each other. Well, if you look at the true M, the CFL condition, I pick a delta T and I pick a delta X. They're fixed, correct? Because I just said I want to discretize first, then optimize. So with the fixed delta T and the fixed delta X I have, and the true M, CFL condition breaks. Obviously, I don't know what the true M is, so I picked something which looked reasonable to me when I started to do my process. But it may not have been reasonable after all. Okay, so if this thing breaks, basically every time M tried to push up, it just says, well, sorry, cannot do that. And the CFL condition breaks. The PD has no resemblance to the true equations that I really have. It doesn't look even like a wave equation because the delta T is too long. And now I cannot do anything about it. And then I just cannot solve it. So it's actually an interesting thing, because what happened is that for the true M, for the true solution, the discretized PDE have no connection to the true PDE. And this is why things break. You have to understand, or you have to realize when you're doing PDEs and optimization, that your discrete problem, at the end of the day, have to do something with the continuous problem. Now, when you're just doing the optimization, you may not think about it. But if you are doing the PDE side, you have to kind of see that the parameter you got at the end have something to do with the true problem you're after. Otherwise, you get stuff like that, which is complete garbage out of your solution. If, on the other hand, you're aware of these things and you say, okay, something here went wrong because my CFL condition went bad, and you're taking your delta T now to be smaller, you start with the same constant, well, then actually you can get an extremely good result for this kind of problem. So it's actually interesting to see that just doing discretize and optimize, like I just advocated before, is not sufficient. You really have to think that your discretization has something to do with the underlying PDE you're solving. Otherwise, you're not going to get anything. You're just solving an algebraic system of equations. You're not really solving anything which is real. You're not solving anything which have any connection to the problem you're really after. So this is the pitfall of discretize versus optimize. You have to think that your discretization has something to do with it. So again, just to kind of to almost finish this lecture, is that if you want to discretize and optimize, then, well, you have to think about what you're doing, really. And you have to think that there is a connection between these two things. And you have to ask yourself, at the end of the day, is there a connection between, so the parameter regime that I found the parameter, I plug it back in the PDE. Does the discretization that I have is doing just for this parameter regime? And we all know that different PDEs can behave differently for different parameter regimes. So that's something that you have to think about. Okay. So here is the summary for this PDE optimization. And again, it's what I believe in. It's not necessarily what everybody else believes in this. But I mean, the fact that it's used in many problems, that's, I guess, it's a non-believer issue. But I like to use the optimization as a framework for the whole thing. I mean, I like to use the discrete optimization approach as a framework because it helps me to find what is a descent direction. It helps me to find merit functions, trust. I can use all the machinery that people have developed for discrete optimization, which becomes harder if you decide to avoid this thing and just solve it as a nonlinear system of PDEs. Okay. And then I try to think dual. I try to think, okay, here's the linear system that I got. What kind of PDE does this correspond to? How would I solve this corresponding PDEs? Can there be any instabilities in this PDE that I get here? Something here can be wrong. I mean, so I try to think about this thing as I do these things together. And I try to use the best of two worlds. So sometimes I'm going to, so we just said that I'm going to use the line search or all the rest of it from the optimization. But the solvers, I may use an optimization solver, but I may use multigrid. So I'm trying to use it from the PDE world. I'm going to try to combine whatever I can to try to find the best piece from every place. There are many, many open questions about these things. So for example, we just talked before, kind of briefly, about the fact that you want to do an inexact Newton. You want to solve this maybe KKT system inaccurately somehow. Well, it's not that clear how to do this in this problem. It's not that clear for SQP literature. It's very hard to find a general way that you can do it and just solve inexactly the KKT system and then still guarantee convergence. You can do it, but there is no guaranteed convergence. So, and there are many, many other important questions here, and this is where maybe lots of research is done in these days. And again, if students want to work on this, it's definitely interesting problems and require some specialty both in PDEs and optimization, which makes it interesting for many people in a sense. And with that, I guess I'm done at 12:02. Yeah. Any questions? So I did not understand anything at the end of the day, that's it?
Can you give us any references on these combination techniques?
So unfortunately, on PDEs and optimization, right now there is no textbook that you can find. There is a bunch of papers and people are publishing, and unfortunately even it's in different fields. So it's really hard even to find one coherent view on the whole thing. So there is, for example, a new book by Gansberg on flow and optimization of flow, something optimization of flow. I actually have the book in my office. And so it's PDEs and optimization. There are some books on shape optimization, but there is no book right now that actually combine or try to take it as a combined view. In inverse problems, for example, so Kurt Vogels have a very nice book on inverse problems which have PDEs and optimization as a part of it. But it's all kind of typical examples, but it's not really in one coherent way put together, unfortunately. For optimization and PDEs separately, they're great books, but not on the combined issue, I guess. It's a book waiting to be written. But
if you have some comments on the relation between the optimal control and this kind of stuff, because in optimal control, people solve it from two ways. One is a direct way, like this person discretize the system and then solve it using optimization. And the other way is to refine the optimality condition and then solve it using boundary value power,
So this is what I showed is exactly the same type. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. So it's the thing is that you can think about everything I showed you as an optimal control problem, and just change the names of M to control and U to state, and it becomes an optimal control problem. But again, the optimal control, they argue between themselves all the time. What's better, to discretize and optimize, or optimize and discretize? Again, I have my personal view that you should. I think discretize and optimize is a better approach. But many people think otherwise. I just ran into one of them in Australia in a meeting 3 weeks ago that told me that everybody who's doing it the other way is just doing nonsense. So I gave a full hour here of nonsense, according to him. But some people think that you have to optimize first and then to discretize, and some people think the other way around. I think that both of them are valid. I don't think that it's a question. I think it's a personal taste question. Personally, I like to discretize first because, again, it allows you to work with optimization algorithms that were invented for optimization. And that kind of makes it easy. If you do it the other way around, then you do have to think about some trivial questions, like how to do a line search, becomes non-trivial at all, because there is discretization errors that go into the equation as well. So you have to consider them, and you have to estimate them somehow, which is a non-trivial issue by itself. So there is a lot of other non-trivial issues that come into the picture if you want to do optimize first, then discretize. Solve it as a boundary value problem, as you say. And it's not that clear that you can do it so easily. Again, people do it, so it's not that this is non-doable.
Another question. Since you use the finite difference to discretize your system, you write the other way, like spectrum method or some other method, would be reduce the optimization size.
So here's the thing. Again, this is again comes to another religion of what you want to use: finite difference, finite volume, finite elements, spectral methods. So there is no answer for this, unfortunately, or fortunately. So people like finite element fine. If you look at spectral methods, then you have to have a certain smoothness to the problem, to the underlying problem. If the problem is not smooth, so if you have jumps, then spectral methods are not necessarily going to be better. The other thing is that you have to consider is of course the matrices in spectral methods are not as sparse. Again, you can deal with this. There are people working on these kind of applications, but the overall thing that you get at the end of the day looks the same. It's just that you have to think about your discretization, what it means, and how you. It has its own mix of stuff. Yeah.
Can you comment on the extension to shape optimization?
So shape optimization, well, it depends how you do it, I guess. But the problem I just showed you can be considered as a shape optimization if you look at the homogenization approach in shape optimization. So in shape optimization, one way to look at shape optimization is to look at and say, well, instead of having material A and material B, I have always a mixture of materials, A plus B. So the solution, there is an inequality constraint, which I did not add here, which you have to have. But it could be either material A or material B or a combination of the two. So in that becomes so then you can present it as a distributed parameter. In this case, our M, this is going to be our control that will solve a PDE in a certain way. And the parameter can lie between values A and B. So it adds another complexity to the problem of the bound constraint on the problem. You can also present it in a different way, a level set approach. But that's another story by itself.
I missed your first part of the presentation. Now I see this last example that you gave when it showed that you got garbage with some parameters.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, you are using explicit integration.
Mm-hmm.
But why?
So why using explicit?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm not saying that you have to use explicit. It's a wave equation. So if you ask most people in the world what would you use for a wave equation, they'll come and say, well, explicit methods. And it's a natural choice for a wave type equation. So in some way, I'm just using the natural choice of most people. If you look at we have a geophysicist here, a real geophysicist. Look at geophysics as a journal. People saw wave equations. I think that 99.9% of the papers are explicit methods. Now, it's a point you want to think about. Should you use implicit methods? Because implicit would never have these kind of things. You'll get inaccuracies, but you will not have this kind of behavior. So it's a question to think about. Again, when you're planning to do PDEs and optimization, you may want to think about using an implicit method rather than an explicit method, although, again, it relates to the cost that you're going to do per iteration. It's going to be much more expensive.
Well, if the most important thing for you is avoiding stupidities, then...
Well, so I said I'm going to say something about it, so now you reminded me. Okay, so here is a question. We can vote on this. What is better to have? An algorithm that gives you an inaccurate result but never explodes, or an algorithm that basically gives you completely garbage, basically explodes? The question is, which one of them is better? Anyone want to take number one? So again, it's a usual and open debate on this thing. And some people would claim that it's much better to have an algorithm which basically gives you garbage, because then you know it's garbage, you know you have a problem, you have to look for it. Rather than just give you something inaccurate that kind of looked real, well, you think about not these problems, these are toy problems. Think about a real problem from a real application. It looks real, so you're the practitioner, you're the engineer, looks at this and say, oh yeah, that looks real, so we should build our NASA space shuttle to look like that. It's not a joke, I guess, anymore, but you know, if the solution looks real, you may do a terrible mistake by doing something. If on the other hand, the solution completely breaks, you can say, okay, something is wrong. I have to trace back and find where it's completely wrong. So in some way, maybe using an explicit method is actually a good thing, because we avoided a very, very inaccurate solution by doing this, while if you have used an implicit integrator, stability would not have been the problem, but the solution would have been grossly inaccurate. So it's always a question to think about. Can we go for lunch?
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's great.